Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, my name is Adam Garfield. I'm the VP of Restaurants at Wix.com.
Awesome, Adam. Thanks so much for finding time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. We're both here in South Florida. I'm in Broward. You're in Dade. Getting super hot out here. Share with us a little bit more about your background, your career timeline, and then I want to spend a few minutes talking about your current role, current organization.
Sure. Yeah, the career background's a fun one. I actually started with a journalism interest, really coming in through college. I went to the University of Florida. And prior to that, you know, I was editor of the paper and was really big into finding the story and everything. And I think no matter what you do in life, telling a good story about it, whether that's as a journalist or as a CEO or as a VP, is very important. But I felt like a journalism major wasn't really going to do much for me. So transferred into finance and graduated in 2009 with a BS in finance from UF, and then moved into Boston. So I was born and raised in Miami. After college, I moved to Boston. Great city, lived there for 5 years and was working in the hedge fund space there, where we were doing independent valuations of different hedge fund portfolios. So this was namely after the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme had become very public. Investors more than ever were looking for third parties to come in and provide that, you know, net asset valuation of those different portfolios. So I did that for 5 years, but really didn't enjoy it as much as maybe some of the other folks did when I looked around. And so I always felt like I wanted to go off on my own and that my calling was kind of more on the entrepreneurial side. And so being in Boston and being in my early 20s, I was always in a rush. We were rushing to work in the morning, grab a coffee and show up late for work because we were waiting in line for coffee during the lunch break. You know, you only have a half hour that you're taking, you're rushing to get a sandwich or a salad and get back to your desk. And then after work, you're heading to the bar where it was slammed to try and get a drink with your coworkers. And in all of those respects, I was wondering, why am I waiting in line to give this business my money so that they can give me a product? And so the idea was, and this was 2012, 2013, why can't I use my phone to order ahead and pay for what I want? And you just let me know when it's ready and I'll skip the line and pick it up. And so that was the genesis for Speedy Tab, which was the company that I founded in 2013 with my co-founder, Ed Gilmore. And that was really focused on order ahead and pay from your phone. So we started in the alcohol space, order ahead and pay for your drink at the bar when we first launched in 2015. But we learned quickly that that wasn't the most ideal sector to launch in. We were trying to really rearrange the entire logistics of how a venue like that operated. You know, there's no defined pickup area, no defined order area. It's kind of a free-for-all, right? And so later that year, we decided, all right, this is not the right space. Why don't we do something like coffee or food where people are ordering this on a daily basis? It's organized. There's a place where people are ordering, a place where they're picking up. And they're often in a hurry to do that. So we quickly launched Speedy Tab at the first coffee shop in Miami called Panther Coffee, which is a popular chain here. And then we launched it at their neighbor, which was Koyo Taco, the most popular taco chain in town. And so right away off the bat, we saw that there was a lot of traction there without much marketing, without much in the way of customer acquisition costs. We were able to start onboarding lots of end users, onboarding more and more merchants. So fast forward a few years, you know, we pivoted that into more of a B2B business where we were providing restaurants with software that they could then brand and white label for their own business, right? So if you're Starbucks, you have millions of dollars in a huge team to launch the Starbucks app, and same for Panera and some of these other large enterprises. But for most restaurants, they don't have the resources to do that themselves. And so SpeedyTab was a way for any restaurant to be empowered to offer that same kind of ordering experience that their big enterprise competitors were offering. And today, you see a lot of third-party delivery marketplaces that are very popular, whether that's Uber Eats or DoorDash or Postmates or Grubhub, it goes on and on. And what the public has come to learn that we've known all along is that, you know, these marketplaces charge huge commissions, often, you know, around 30%, and they retain all the customer data from the restaurant. So I don't know if it's John's first time at my pizza shop, if it's his 100th time, does he like cheese or does he like pepperoni? Does he like calzones? How do I market to him again? And so what SpeedyTab did was put the power back in the restaurant's hands by letting them have their own direct channel so that they can re-engage with John as a customer, know who he is, be able to let him order directly from them. And so over the years, SpeedyTab did that for about 3,000 locations across the country. And in 2021, February, we were acquired by Wix.com, which brings me to my current role.
Well, that's super exciting. What a journey, and appreciate telling us a little bit more about kind of the background of that and how you came about building your company and then later getting acquired by Wix. So from this journey, in terms of you guys building the company, you're pivoting a lot, which is pretty, you know, in startup space, me as a former, you know, founder, operator of multiple startups of my own, it's a pretty standard. You pivot almost on a daily basis, and you got to be able to have that, you know, that capacity to handle that type of change adjustment. When we talk about the later part of your organization, the growth and then getting acquired by Wix, share with us kind of that period. What were you guys going through, and more specifically around some of the listeners that we have are also entrepreneurs and startup founders themselves, and some of the questions that we see in our community is also, how do these conversations with potential acquirer actually come about? From my experience, when my company got acquired, it all started with talks of a partnership. Oh, you know, let's discuss a potential partnership and how do we collaborate together, and then seeing how basically we collaborate, how the cultures melt together. And from there, that's how the conversation started. Curious from your standpoint, what has been experience like, and what, if any, recommendations you have from that standpoint?
Yeah, great questions. So I'll start with, more than anything, we've always been a heavily product-focused company. And I think more than anything else, that's what's been to our benefit, is a heavy, almost unrelenting focus on products. Whether that's just our team resources has always been product focused, our management team's always been product focused. And even during that growth phase, it's easy to get distracted sometimes by the noise of the market. And it's really important to be hyper focused on creating a genuinely easy to use and strong product and listening to your customers and your customer pain points. It's also easy at that phase to listen to customer feature requests and bells and whistles and things that would be nice. But my co-founder and I always found it that if you could hear what their pain points were and their problems more so than their recommendations and their feature requests, that can help guide the product in a way that you're solving problems that many of your customers are probably facing, and helps you create a better product. So that was always first and foremost. Beyond that heavy product focus, you know, we started through, especially the COVID period, experiencing, you know, tremendous growth across all of our KPIs. And that led to a lot of partnership discussions and a lot of larger players coming into the space and looking at restaurant technology in a way that maybe they hadn't in the past. For good reason, more restaurants were going onto the web and into digital than ever before. And they were probably the hardest hit segment out of any business segment during COVID, with a need, you know, for them to keep their doors open, they had to go online practically to maintain their sales. So for Speedy Tab and Wix, it was somewhat of a by chance original meeting, which is that Wix has an office here in Miami and Speedy Tab's located here in Miami. And I was actually at an event in their local offices here where I had met the head of that office. And I had known that Wix had a restaurant product at the time, but I saw, you know, how strong that product could be with the platform that Speedy Tab could bring into the fold. And so I asked if they could introduce me to the head of the restaurant product and team. And so we started having discussions there around, you know, partnership and how we could help. And those discussions kind of evolved in their own right into eventually the M&A opportunity that was in front of us. But I think more than anything, even during that whole time, there's a continued focus at Speedy Tab on product and acquiring customers down to like the very last day. So I remember even leading up to signing the deal for acquisition, we were still onboarding customers, we're still launching new customers, we're still launching new features. There's this almost paranoid sense that we're gonna just continue no matter what to build the best product. And so that's really what got us to today, is this combination of heavy product focus and then the right opportunities in terms of meetings, being in the right place and networking with the right people. And then the macro factors being, you know, there's a lot of consolidation and focus in restaurant tech because of the growth that was happening in this industry. So within Wix, for instance, one of the fastest growing segments of anyone creating a website is the restaurant segment. So clearly there's a strong need for them to really improve that, or for us to really improve that product. And that's why it was such a natural fit together.
Well, that's very interesting. And thanks for sharing some of the details behind that. And as far as, so you guys have, how big was the team at the time?
Yeah, so just under 20 people.
Under 20. And Wix is how big? A couple hundred?
5,000.
I'm way off. So with your company, obviously as a startup, you know, make and break type of mentality, you're moving very fast, now joining and being part of a much larger organization. Was that a concern at all for you? How did you go through that period? And what was the adjustment like being part of something much bigger, I guess, at this point?
Yeah, great question. I think the first thing in moving forward with Wix in the first place was that we believed that there was really, an opportunity to create a monster within the restaurant tech space. So the goal has always been to impact as many restaurant businesses positively as possible. And how do you have the biggest impact? You need to have tremendous resources. And so we believe that Wix was really well positioned with their product and their resources to do that. And B was really culturally making sure that there was a fit between the teams and the company ethos and the people. And so one of the things that Wix did in the early stages was they actually brought in their head of people into one of the first meetings. And that was a different tack than some of the other folks that we were speaking with at the time. And so we really appreciated that. We learned a lot about Wix, their culture, and how they care about their team, their people, their vision for the future. And so that was a big differentiator for us with them. Now, that being said, there's always going to be an adjustment coming into a new company, especially one, you know, that has 5,000 plus employees when you're just under 20 employees. Wix is structured in a way that they have multiple kind of companies within a larger umbrella company of Wix. So each company within Wix has its own P&L and its own team. So we almost operate as a smaller startup within the larger corporate structure of Wix. So Wix Restaurants is almost a startup of its own within the larger umbrella of Wix, with the bonus of being able to have, you know, the great resources from the main corporate entity in terms of whether that's, you know, marketing spend, whether that's design, whether that's, you know, funnel or whatever it might be. So there's opportunity to join a large organization, but still act and be agile enough to be in a small org.
Well, that's very cool. And the majority of the team from the early days still with Wix?
Yeah, the whole team is still at Wix, which is really important. It was really great when we spoke with the team about acquisition. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't a focus on financial. It wasn't a focus on anything other than can we still work together, and just like an excitement for the future still. So the full team is still at Wix, and that's a big part of it. Was, you know, is this the right move for us as a team, our employees, our customers, and the shareholders? So all of those folks have to be happy at the same time, and we were fortunate enough that was the case.
Awesome, that's great. And did you guys bootstrap initially, or did you go the fundraising route, angel investments? Share with us a little bit more through that period.
Yeah, I mean, we were largely bootstrapped. So we started off really on my life savings. And Ed and I worked without a salary for years, probably like most founders during that startup journey, especially first-time founders. And then throughout, over time, we raised some capital, just over like $3 million. But nothing, I mean, in 2021 these days, you can have a seed round that's $15 million seed. So, I mean, this was 2014, 2015, so it was a bit different. Mm-hmm. But still, I'd say largely we kept it small. We focused as much on growth as we did on profitability. So a lot of especially venture-backed companies are on a certain trajectory, and they have to maintain a growth trajectory over so much of profitability trajectory. And that can be a whole nother podcast or discussion in its own right, and how do you balance those things. But we felt like we were actually in a very strong position at the end of the day, which was we were a profitable company that was seeing strong growth at the same time. So, we weren't just funneling, you know, money into customer acquisition and into marketing and just chasing a top line growth. We were able to build stable, positive EBITDA while having that tremendous top line growth that you want to see as a startup that's in that phase of expansion.
Right. Wow. Yeah, that's very cool. And from a standpoint, I see that a lot because I'm being in venture capital and as an angel investor, I'm part of a lot of the syndicates, and I see a lot in founders myself where that kind of infusion of cash or venture capital that's coming into the startup, a lot of founders tend to almost lose focus on that growth and really, you know, customer acquisition and anything that's very important at the core of their organization to continue that, you know, the business development, sales, and whatever the case may be. They start participating in, you know, the conferences, they launch their own podcasts or a lot of
only now that I'm allowed to do the podcast. I wasn't doing podcasts before.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So that's a good point. And, you know, a lot of them, I hear some founders now like launching their like rolling funds and things like that, which is very interesting to me. And from a standpoint of your recommendation for founders who are at that cusp of where they had proven product market fit initially, they've gotten some traction, and they're on that verge of deciding whether to go the fundraising route or not. What are your thoughts on that when you talk to other entrepreneurs? What's your recommendation?
Yeah, it's a very founder personal decision, I feel like. And so, you know, it's not for me to say what others should do in that realm. To each approach it differently. For Ed and I, we took the approach of really this being our baby. And the more venture that you raise and the more you go down that road, the narrower that kind of road becomes at the end, right? And so what we really enjoyed was the amount of flexibility that we had with the business and the amount of control. You know, on the flip side, you're not strapped to a rocket ship as much as you are with venture funding, and some of the doors and strategic value that venture partners can have aren't as accessible to you. So those would be cons, but the pros are certainly you have a lot more freedom and flexibility in terms of not just from a strategic product perspective and business strategy decisions, but also when you're looking at, you know, the eventual exit of that company, you know, the world is much more your oyster versus, you know, the kind of the venture portion of that.
Yeah. No, I love that recommendation. And I appreciate the insight, everything you had shared with us through that journey. So in terms of moving on to next, what are some of the trends and ideas that really excite you these days? What are you passionate about? Perhaps what are you researching, maybe looking to invest into further? Share with us some of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm largely still passionate about restaurants. It's the space that, you know, I've lived and breathed over the last 8 years. And there's a speed at which this sector is evolving that is somewhat unparalleled. You know, when we started in 2014, there really were just a handful of restaurant technology companies. And this was a very legacy infrastructure that we were trying to crack. And in 2021, it's quite the opposite. It's a very competitive landscape, and it's a very quickly evolving landscape. And I think that's exciting. It's exciting across all facets of it, right? You have the business model of restaurants themselves that are evolving, right? More than ever, you have ghost kitchens or cloud kitchens, whatever the nomenclature is that you want to use. But you have more and more concepts that provide food that may or may not have a physical location that you can visit. And so I think that lends itself to a lot of interesting opportunities. It's almost a mixture of real estate opportunities and food tech opportunities. There's also been a lot of consolidation in the space overall, not just with Wix and SpeedyTab, but with others. So it's interesting to see how that will affect restaurant operators moving forward. You know, owners of these businesses over the last century are unique versus other sectors in that they're often starting a business because of emotional, personal reasons, right? It's how their mother's meatballs made them feel, and they want to share that feeling on. It's the way their family gathered on Friday nights at the dinner table, and they love that sense of community that they want others to feel. So there's a very personal sense that differs from laundromats, right? There might be some people that are passionate about pressing shirts, but those folks are often way more driven by, you know, ROI than our restaurant people. And so it's a very passionate sector. It's a very emotional sector. And so there's really a struggle or battle right now, I think, between the independent operators and the enterprise and third-party marketplaces, right? So more and more third-party marketplaces are going to try and dominate all aspects and the full supply chain, right? So if I'm Uber Eats, not only are we the marketplace that's delivering your dinner and also your groceries and your alcohol and whatever else we can deliver, but we also want that to be our own concept. Why even go to independent concepts anymore? If we know, since we have all the data, that downtown Miami-Dade is lacking in hot and artisanal pizza, we can launch our own pizza, virtual pizza concept on Uber Eats, where we control all the supply chain behind that, and it's much more profitable for us as a business. So I'm very passionate about how do we help the independent operators battle against that, and that's really come down to how easy you can make it for people to order from you. Humans naturally are going to go towards the path of least resistance. And so the easier you can make it for someone to order, the more likely they are to place that order. And so there's a lot of emphasis on how do we help restaurants really do that? Make it as easy as possible for people to order from them, and then to be able to connect with them and come back more and more often. So that's kind of like my main focus still. Unrelated to that, there's there's lots of new interests and passion. I think there's been so much going on in NFT right now that I'm just trying to like keep up to speed with everything going on. There's some interesting startups here locally, actually, even in South Florida, around that. And then I'm always interested in the personal pain points otherwise that are going on then, and looking for companies that are solving those. So I think that the best companies are always personal pain point based versus searching for a solution. So I like seeing what pain points I have and seeing what companies maybe are tackling those that I can invest in or be interested in.
Yeah, and you'd be surprised how, you know, it's an everyday life that we oftentimes don't even consider that. And I've seen, you know, I'm advising or invested in various startups, and I agree with you that the best products that I had seen so far is everything that has been born outside of that particular personal need, whether that's you're dealing with something on a day-to-day basis or at work and so forth, and you actually coming up with a solution how to fix that. Because at the end of the day, if you're experiencing that problem, most likely a lot of other people actually experiencing the same. So that's a great analogy.
Yeah, and I think, you know, further to that, it doesn't necessarily have to be like in your outside of work life. So perhaps you're an engineer that's listening to this, and you might encounter problems or inefficiencies that you run into as an engineer that you want to improve on and launch a new product to address. And so that's as much of a really interesting segment of that as is someone, you know, that's, you know, got a newborn baby and I'm sure is running into 15 different things on a daily basis that can be done more efficiently and improved upon.
Yes, absolutely. And as I'm talking to a lot of the founders, whether it's in my portfolio or not, there's kind of these three walls that I like to, you know, focus on in terms of where the founders run into, whether that's lack of focus, what you and I discussed, maybe lack of skill or stretching yourself too thin, whether you are really good at, you know, business development and you're trying to do something else within the organization. And also kind of the third wall is ability to recruit, ability to surround yourself with A players, like-minded folks, and folks that those bring something to the table where you don't have, which in the startup world, it's critical. It's very important. And for you as a founder, I'm pretty sure you had to get better at that game with every day, being able to recruit the best people. Share with us any of the strategies that worked well for you through that period, your ability to recruit, and not only recruit, but also retain.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, team is of utmost importance, right? At such a small and young position, every hire just has a tremendous impact. And so that started from the very beginning. Obviously, my background wasn't technical. And one of the questions that I get asked most often is, how do I find a technical co-founder, right? And so my first question back is, well, what have you tried? What have you done so far? And so the very first thing is, you have to communicate and get out there and tell people about what you're building and meet those people in real life. And so whether that's engineering geared meetups, I know during COVID that's probably not as easy, but whether that's going to virtual meetups or in-person meetups, being in spaces where, you know, those kinds of leading technical people are going to be. So my co-founder and our CTO, back in 2013, I had told everyone in my network on the project that I wanted to build. And I had told everyone that I was looking for a technical co-founder. And I had posted this across all my social channels. And eventually someone from college had reached out to me and actually brought my co-founder with them to a meeting. And so I didn't know my co-founder prior to that. But we met then, we got along. I brought a stack of like legal papers that I had drawn our wireframes on, and went over those with him along with like the vision, and the rest was kind of history. So I think the first thing was really leveraging every resource that I had to spread my net as wide as possible. And once we had, you know, Ed on board as my co-founder, it's really then acting as a referral network. We relied almost 100% on referral and word of mouth. And I think when you have an exciting project and the start of a great product. That's, I mean, your number one job as CEO and as founder is to sell the vision. And I think sometimes people either lose sight of that or aren't able to communicate that as effectively as they need to be. And so the number one thing is, what is the story? What is your vision for this company? And what is the company's mission? And how am I going to get others to be as passionate about it as I am? Because that's really the number one thing across all of our employees, is we need people that are really just as passionate about this project as I am, as the founder, because it's not gonna be easy, right? And people are gonna wear a ton of different hats, and people are gonna be working crazy hours, and they're gonna be stressed to the max. And so what keeps everyone going beyond that is really a passion and excitement about what they're doing. And for us, we're even more lucky because you're really able to go out into the everyday world and interact with our products, right? Like if you're going to go get a cup of coffee, you can use our technology to do that. Or, you know, if we're meeting a potential, engineer for a role, I would like to meet them usually at like one of our customers so they can even see the product in use. And it just gets like that next level of excitement. And that was still like the most exciting day for me, is just sitting back and watching people I didn't know, you know, use the platform for the first time. So it's really A, being able to communicate the vision of the company effectively to get others excited, and B, really leveraging your network for referrals and people that you know personally, or friends of friends and things like that. We never really went to an outside recruiter or third-party firm or did anything along those lines, or hired someone like off Indeed or, you know, anything like that. I wouldn't know actually the first thing on doing any of those things. We did it all really off a referral basis.
That's great. And as they say, your network is your net worth. At the end of the day, it's oftentimes overlooked, the power of that, but it's a contact sport. And as you've mentioned, you know, bulk of your guys' business also came from a referrals. So that, you know, it's a great example of that. And I hear that question or that comment a lot from other founders is, you know, how do I go about expanding my network? How do I go about networking and things like that? Networking is always, you know, so overrated that, and it's a lot of just essentially boils down to some of the basics to be able to leverage your current network, you know, make yourself available out there, put yourself in a, you know, in a position where you have those opportunities to connect with those people. So that's, you know, that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was reading just yesterday, someone posted, you know, when we're recording this, it's just days after the Coinbase direct listing IPO.
Yeah.
Someone posted the Hacker News listing from Brian Armstrong of him looking for his co-founder.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I shared that as well on my LinkedIn, and it was pretty funny too. Kind of his post, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, so it shows, I mean, and they just IPO'd at what, you know, around 100 billion, I want to say, as far as market cap. So you had even Brian Armstrong of Coinbase posting on social about finding a co-founder and the importance of it. So there's like a common modern day example.
Absolutely. And some of the comments to that post, they were very funny. It was unbelievable. Yeah. That was an awesome post. And so Adam, kind of in closure, want to ask a few questions around your personal kind of content diet. What do you consume on a daily basis? What's in your bookmarks? What do you follow on Twitter and so forth? Share with us any sources that are useful to you.
Yeah, great question. I keep up on my restaurant news probably first and foremost. So I'm on and perusing most of the restaurant blogs and restaurant tech blogs more than anything. So I'm up there on Eater, consuming content from each of the different city specifics to look at common urban cores and see the trends that are going on, not just in my backyard here in Miami, but I want to know what's happening in the New York market and the LA market. And then moving that over to like fastcasual.com to see general kind of hospitality news for us, to really ensure that I'm reading about anything that's happening within the restaurant space. I want to know first and foremost. And then really I've been on a like voracious book diet lately. a lot on negotiation, just because I felt like that was something growing up and into college and into my professional career that I needed to work on a lot. So just read the Chris Voss book on negotiation, which I thought was really great. And I read that after reading the Harvard Business School, Harvard Negotiation Project book. So they're very interesting to read those back to back because they have conflicting ideology between the two of them. And then I just also finished the Happiness Advantage, which is kind of like a different tack to have, but on the balance side, to really talk about, things like perception, things like gratitude, and they sound kind of cheesy, but they're really important things. And it has also great lessons that actually go back into what we're doing at Wix, and in terms of making it easy for people to order at restaurants. It talks about really human nature and our desirability to go towards things that are as easy as possible to do. So for instance, like learning guitar is easier if the guitar is left out in your living room versus in a guitar case under the bed. Just the extra 30 seconds that it takes for you to pull the guitar out of the guitar case to play it is enough of a reason for you to tell yourself in your head, it's too hard today, I'll do it tomorrow, versus it just being open and available to you. So I like balancing it all like that. Twitter-wise, I've just gotten into Twitter really since Miami Tech kind of started becoming a thing last year, and the mayor, Francis Suarez, started kind of the tweet storm of all the activity that he was leading and all the folks moving into town. I said, okay, I guess I better pay attention to Twitter. So I'm starting to try and get more involved in Twitter, but I can see like what a dark hole that can really devolve into. So I'm trying to balance, I was kind of happy in my, I have like a forum group, which is if you're in like YPO or organizations like that, EO, they have like a monthly group of meeting of entrepreneurs. I was proud that I had the lowest screen time of the group, but it's now been inching up heavily ever since getting onto Twitter. So I'm trying to balance my screen time at like 5 hours and change at a healthy pace.
That's funny, because I'm the same way. I'm kind of a late to a party when it comes to Twitter. Yeah. I just recently started that, and I can definitely relate to how that could become, you know, just that particular space that's
In Clubhouse. I mean, people spend a lot of time on Clubhouse these days. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't personally. I'm a very visual person. I'm not an auditory person as much. So, ironically, we're on a podcast. But I just haven't been able, I think, thankfully, to get into the Clubhouse realm as much either. Just because it doesn't do it for me like a visual does. So I've actually started on my side a YouTube channel, trying on the flip side to kind of more visually tell a story of post-acquisition life, and also kind of like learnings from the 8 years of starting SpeedyTab, growing SpeedyTab, and eventually being acquired.
That's awesome. That's super cool. Adam Kim, thank you enough for your time today. Lots of great insights. I personally learned quite a bit. I love conversations like this. It's definitely not going to be our last recording. I'm going to stay in touch with you and perhaps do another show towards the end of the year and see how much I've transpired.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks so much for having me on, John. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.